WYBC New Haven.
First time I saw The Wizard of Oz, I couldn't sleep all night because of the Wicked Witch of the West. And I will never, ever, ever forget it.
What about the Wicked Witch of the West was so scary?
Well, she was green and she had a crooked nose. She looked funny. And the worst part was that I had this weird dream where, like, my aunt, who could do, "I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too," really, really well, with, like, the voice of the witch, and the witch was chasing me, and I can always remember that.
There's things that scare you, Allison.
Lions and bats and bears.
Why do they scare you?
Because they're scary.
Tigers and bears. Lions and tigers and bears.
Lions and tigers and bears. Oh my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh my.
Welcome to the Radley Porch. I'm Rachel Haverford.
And I'm Lonnie Atkinson. This week, we've gathered some friends together on our porch to talk about the little childhood traumas that have stayed with us until today.
What were some of the irrational fears that loom large in your young worlds? What experiences still seem oddly vivid? And what small crimes still haunt you?
One of our favorite childhood authors, Roald Dahl, reveals the exaggerated proportions that the world takes on from a child's perspective in the description of his headmaster.
I have a picture in my mind of a giant of a man with a face like a ham and a mass of rusty-colored hair that sprouted in a tangle all over the top of his head. All grown-ups appear as giants to small children, but headmasters and policemen are the biggest giants of all and acquire a marvelously exaggerated stature. It is possible that Mr. Coombs was a perfectly normal being, but in my memory he was a giant, a tweed-suited giant who always wore a black gown over his tweeds and a waistcoat under his jacket.
I think it's funny, like, as a kid, your ability to just, like, brood about it, right? Like, okay, I can't tell anyone about this. I'm just gonna, not confront it. And, like, I think that's what makes it traumatic, is because you, like, build it up in your head.
And you don't quite have the reasoning capacity to know that what you're worrying about is not actually something realistic or something that will happen.
Definitely as a little kid, things, like, seem huge in your head. I remember this one time I was hiking with my family, and we were going up this mountain. And my mom and my little brother was, like, 4 at the time. I was 6. So my little brother clearly wasn't going to make it to the top. So my mom and him stayed behind. And my dad went on, but then I was kind of getting tired. And I was like, I don't think I can make it. So my dad, I don't really know why, but he was like, okay, just stay here. And I'm going to go on to the top. And, you know, I'll be down in, like, 15 minutes. But I didn't have a watch. And as a little kid, you have no sense of time at all. So it's just, so I'm sitting here, and instead of thinking, okay, like, I'm just sitting here on the trail, clearly, you know, I haven't moved, my dad's gonna be able to find me, you know, because trails were confusing to me, I wouldn't have been able to find myself again. And also, you're in the middle of the woods and you can't see anyone and you just feel like you're in danger. And so I was sitting there. So then I guess I started panicking, and I, like, ran down the trail a little ways, maybe thinking I could get back to my mom and brother, but, you know, I probably went, like, you know, 100 yards, and then I turned around and went back up the mountain, and it was kind of cold. I remember, like, I could see my breath, and there were, like, some icicles hanging from some rocks, and I definitely took this as a sign of danger, like, oh, it's freezing, and there's icicles. So I'm kind of panicked, and I run into these two middle-aged women, and at this point I'm crying, and I'm like, I don't know where my dad is, I'm lost in the mountain. And then I see him, he's like sprinting down, because clearly he knows I'm probably worried at this point. And so then, you know, I'm just hysterical, I'm like, that's him, that's my dad. It was like such relief, but I really thought, like, I'm in danger, I'm lost in the mountain, I'm probably gonna die. And, you know, in retrospect, I should have just sat still and, like, you know, played number games in my head or something. But you have no sense of time or relative danger.
When I was little, I used to be so scared that somebody was going to come kill me in my sleep that I'd take all of my stuffed animals and surround myself with them and put them on top of me, thinking that if somebody came in and went to get me, they wouldn't be able to get past a stuffed animal.
One thing I was always afraid of was that, like, mice were going to climb up my bed. I don't even know if we had mice in our house. But I always, like, had to pull all the covers so nothing was hanging over the bed. Because if there was, like, a cover hanging over, then they would probably climb up that. But as long as I pulled all the covers up onto the bed, then, like, I was safer from the mice climbing up onto me while I slept.
I have this weird fear of something living under my bed. Which I think a lot of kids have,
yeah, it's
right?
Like the monster under the bed. Or...
But, and so, like, periodically, like, maybe every day, I would, like, climb under my bed and just, like, stay there. I would just, like, lie there for, like, 10 minutes. And be like, lie there 10 minutes and it's okay. And, like, no one has come, like, taking up residence here. So, I'll be fine. I think it freaked my parents out more because they would come into my room and, like, they'd know I was in there at one moment and, like, now under everything.
Why? You scared of? When you were a little boy?
To be completely honest, I don't remember.
How's
that?
What?
I did realize I had a...
Were you scared, though, of that?
You know, I probably would have been if I saw one. Hey, Allison, do you have bad dreams?
No. Good.
I had a bad dream that would always keep coming back to me. Huh? I'd wake up... For years, I had this recurring dream. I'd wake up with the feeling I had a mouthful of styrofoam.
Why?
I don't know why, but a mouthful of styrofoam, and then I couldn't breathe. And sometimes I'd be face down in a puddle of water, like muddy water, and I'd wake up gasping for breath. That was my recurring nightmare.
How old were you when you had the dream?
You know, I'm not sure when it started. I was probably, you know, 5 or 6, because I don't really remember anything before 4. But I was having that dream. I mean, I remember having it in high school even. So I don't have no idea why. I do know that I'd wake up with my face in a pillow. So that was, I mean, the not being able to breathe part was actually pretty important. But yeah, it was the same dream. Same dream.
And did you have problems with, like, water or styrofoam or any of
you
these?
You know, styrofoam has... I've never eaten styrofoam.
Unlike most of us.
But, you know, there are some things that set you on edge, like fingernails on a chalkboard. Mm-hmm. And somehow, I know the idea of a mouthful of styrofoam would be like that to me.
My friend has the same thing with dry napkins. I remember, like, the idea, like, that the friction...
I don't know, like, what it is. I think it's it's that squeak and the chew.
And the dryness.
And the dryness, yeah. It causes me anxiety. Not that I sit here and I'm thinking of eating styrofoam, but I'm just saying this is a recurring thing for many years.
And I think that's a distinct memory if you can remember it from when you were 5 years old.
Well, I guess I don't remember when it began, mm-hmm. but I remember it was a recurring and pretty intense, you know, dream I'd wake up from all the time.
Maybe in a past life you died from styrofoam suffocation.
Let's just hope it's a past life and not a foretelling. So if I find myself drowning in a pit of styrofoam, I'll be really pissed off. I lived a pretty bland childhood. I wasn't afraid of many things. My brother, he terrorized me, but, you know.
That's a real fear. I think, like, the things, some of the stories that we've enjoyed is the idea when you're a child and you have a really vivid imagination, that your imagination just builds things up, especially since you might not be very upfront with your parents all the time, or they're not in your head,
right.
And you can't really vocalize all these things. So suddenly really small things become humongous.
Oh, speaking of small things becoming humongous, I remember this is my brother and my sister. My parents were out, I'm the youngest, my brother and sister were babysitting me. My brother was the ringleader of the group. And we're all in my parents' bed. I was probably 4, 5. I was 5. And, you know, if you're laying in bed at night and you put a flashlight up to the ceiling and put your hand up in the air and bring it down closer to the flashlight, the hand looks like it's descending upon you. I don't know how many times he did it to me that night. Why I kept looking, I don't know, but had me absolutely petrified that this hand was coming to get me. I never kind of figured it out. So he would do those kinds of little things to me all the time, telling scary stories, you know, that kind of stuff. But I swear I don't remember any, like, consistent fears. And if I do, I really repress them exceedingly well. You know, I was actually an anxious child, but, well, maybe that's a fear. I don't know. I remember in third grade, I had to start going to school early because, and I was a good student, but I was so worried or afraid of getting things wrong. The teachers wanted me to come in early just to, like, so I could do my homework again while they were there, even though I'd do fine, like, just to calm me down because I was so anxious.
So you're afraid to get things wrong?
I guess so. I mean, I don't remember what it was, but I was worried. I was a worrywart. As I think back, I didn't have any unusual fears about monsters. You know, there'd be like the, is there something under the bed kind of thing, or, you know, a completely dark house. What's that?
The basement?
No.
That was always.
Never the basement.
I always had to, like, if I had to get something down there, I would, like, try and walk down slowly, but then when I was coming back, I had to...
Because it's the furnace, right? For me, I think there's, like, this furnace that would like, heat up, obviously, when the temperature needed to be, but, like, I didn't understand that, and so I thought it was because I was down there, like, I've awoken something, and it's, like, coming alive before me.
Well, I never had the furnace. There was the wind that would whistle through the front doors. It would just hit a right a harmonic, and they thought, oh my gosh.
Is there any part of the house that you're afraid to go to alone? Like, I was always afraid to go down to the basement.
There is a place. Going to my dad's office without turning the light on really gets scary.
Why is that?
In the rooms, there's, like, only, like, one window. And then it's, like, a really small one, about, like, 3x3, maybe. Like, really small. It's, like, this big. And then that's, like, the only window. And I have to turn the light on, like, I don't know, when they turn the lights on, it flickers. So I always get scared.
I mean, the main thing, as I think about it, is worrying about school. Or classwork, or something like that. I was always a good student, but it would just... In fact, when I was in high school, I was taking... it was a 3-year high school, so I was in 10th grade, and taking all these honors and AP classes, or something like that. The highest level of whatever. And I was also in the jazz ensemble, and also playing football, and all sorts of... It was just too much stuff. And I started getting... basically what would be like an ulcer. And my parents said, why are you taking all these classes? This is crazy. What are you doing? And I thought I was just supposed to. All my friends were doing the same things. They weren't doing as many extracurriculars, but they're doing all the same classes. So I just thought that was just what you did.
So you got an ulcer at like age 16?
No, I was probably on the verge of getting one. I mean, upset stomach would hurt all the time. It's more going into certain classes. So for the first time in my life, I got a tutor for stoichiometry, still remember the word. And this guy basically just taught me one physics problem and taught me how you can move all these things around, you know, force equals mass times acceleration. For an hour, we worked on that same thing conceptually, and like all the problems disappeared. It's like all of a sudden I could figure these things out. So, but he calmed me down. And so after that semester, I dropped down a level in 2 of these 7 classes. To the regular, whatever, chemistry or physics. And, you know, neither class was all that challenging anymore, but, you know, my stomach stopped hurting. You know, a few of my friends thought, one friend in particular pulled me aside with tears in his eyes, you know, that I was giving up my whole future by doing this. But, you know, but I ran with a crowd of people like who track into places like Yale and Harvard and Johns Hopkins and Columbia and all that kind of stuff. That's just the folks I hung out with. But it became too much. Now, that was never fear. Well, and what's the difference between anxiety and fear? I don't, you know, literally know. But it was anxiety, absolutely.
So how old were you when you start going into school early?
I just did it for a while in 3rd grade. And that was it. I sort of needed to be, you know, reassured.
It was like the tutor?
It was like the tutor, yeah, essentially. It was just, you know, I might have gone in. If I went in, twice a week for a month, I'd be surprised if it was that much. I just needed to, I guess I needed reassurance or something like that.
Something you said reminded me of when I was a kid, and in like on the second floor there was this picture of Abraham Lincoln, but it was from his like later years, so when he's kind of gaunt and like really skinny,
right.
And it's a very dark picture in the first place, and I think it was like in the stairs to the second floor, and so it was like right at the top of the stairs. I don't know why we had this, but I was like 5 years old and I just couldn't go upstairs. I like refused to go upstairs because, and if I did, I'd like close my eyes as I'm going up the stairs and like not have to look at the picture.
That's amazing. You know, talking about these things, it is bringing things back. There was a picture in my house I was terrified of, and it was a self-portrait of this artist. His last name is Burkhart. I want to say his first name is Emerson, but I'm not sure about that. But my parents, when they got married, lived above his garage. He's this crazy old man, but a prolific painter. And he gave them as a wedding present a self-portrait. It's a beautiful piece. And I always thought it looked like my grandfather. But it was at the bottom of the stairs, at the landing for the turn in the basement. And like I said, I was never afraid of the basement, but the idea of that picture, I could have sworn it was following me. You know, the eyes and such. I forgot about that.
I feel like for me, like the Disney, like moments in Disney movies that like scared me the most, like I think that like I was actually like more scared by like real things, like the moment in Aladdin when like Jasmine is like inside the hourglass and you're worried she's gonna, like basically the implications that she's gonna suffocate if she doesn't get out, like that was so like terrifying for me. Or like Gaston was like always my like the Disney like villain that I feared the most, because he's basically just like a big guy, like that's all he is, and that was just really like terrifying to me.
I saw The Shining at a certain I was doing
bad call.
And I don't really like horror movies. I never found them very scary, but for some reason The Shining really disturbed me. And about a week after I had seen it, we took a vacation in rural Washington with my parents. I went with my parents, and it was in this place that you could only get to by boat. It was at the end of a lake, so you drive 3 hours from Seattle, and you get on a boat at the end of this lake, and then take a boat to the other end. And they don't have telephones; they just have this one satellite phone. There really is nothing there. And so we rented this house, and at the kind of end of it's not an island, but the bit at the end of the lake. And we get out there, and in the yard of this house we'd rented was a chopping block.
And then there were these
with
two
an
axe.
No, there were no twins. But there were, you had to chop your own wood if you wanted to make a fire. And I told my father he was not to chop wood. We would not have fires. There was going to be no wood chopping.
I love scary movies. I haven't seen many scary movies, but I really, really like
kind of
them.
Movies.
So what's a movie that's kind of scary that you like?
Well, I like Aladdin and The Sound of Music. Number one, The Sound of Music, the soldiers escape, and in Aladdin it's Jafar. I don't know why I haven't seen it since I was like five.
But no, it is scary, the part where like Jafar comes out of the lamp and he's all like big. I don't know,
yeah it's like the worst part of the movie.
Or like in The Little Mermaid when Ursula gets all big at the end.
Ursula, The Little Mermaid, Cinderella. No, not really Cinderella.
No, because they have the witch at the end when it's raining.
Yeah.
No, that's not Cinderella. It's Snow White.
I know Beauty and the Beast is sort of scary. A lot of the Disney movies, probably.
Which one do you consider the scariest?
I have three personal ones. Sleeping Beauty, The Little Mermaid, and Snow White. Or my three personal movies that are probably the scariest that I've ever seen.
The beast will make off with your children. He'll come after them in the night.
No.
We're not safe till his head is mounted on my wall. I say we kill the beast!
We're not safe until he's dead. He'll come stalking us at night.
Said to sacrifice our children to his monstrous appetite.
He'll wreak havoc on our village if we let him wander free. So it's time to take some action, boys. It's time to follow me. Through the mist, through the woods, through the darkness and the shadows. It's a nightmare, but it's one exciting ride. Say a prayer, then we're there at the drawbridge of a castle, and there's something truly terrible inside. It's a beast, he's got fangs, razor sharp ones, massive paws, killer claws for the feast. Hear him roar, see him foam, but we're not coming home till he's dead. Good and dead! Kill the beast!
No!
Not with us, you're against
You've been
us.
Listening to the Radley Porch on Yale Radio 1340.
Traumatic is somewhat of a strong word to be using for what we're characterizing.
But the tiny things
like that are pretty traumatic. Yeah, or like, it. For some reason, it's like your memory is like a trauma. It's like a trauma in some way. Like, the vivid nature of it somehow, like, seems... It had to be traumatic, or, like, why would you remember it in such detail?
So, first grade... My teacher just, like, hated children or something. I don't really know why she's a teacher. But, she gathered us around one day, you know, on the little rug, and she was like, guys, I have something really serious to tell you. You're not going to have any summer vacation this year because the school board's going to take it away from you. And, like, apparently there was not even any proposal. Like, there was not even any chance of this happening for real. And, like, so then for the next, like, 4 years... I was always, like, every, at the end of every school year, I was like, oh my gosh, are we really going
to
get
vacation
or not? Are we going
to,
like, are they going to take it away from us? But that stopped being traumatic.
Like, learning syllables was just, like, a really, like, hard experience for me. I think it was partially because I was always, like, a smart kid, and so I could pick up on things really easily in school, and so, like, I listened to, like, the first 10 minutes of whatever lesson and then, like, not listen anymore. But this was, like, one lesson that I just couldn't get. Like, no matter what, I couldn't understand, like, how you counted syllables and, like, what were these things and, like, how some words, like, you would imagine to be... I think squirrel has come up, like, a bunch of times.
Yeah.
But, like, you'd imagine that to be, like, at least three three syllables. And, like, it's not. And you're like, it's not adding up. Like, something is wrong. And so...
Two vowels.
Right, like, so I would base it on the number of vowels. Like, I think, like, I've always thought in a very quantitative way. And so I'd, like, count the number of vowels and, like, use that as a guessing, like, measuring stick of some sort. And, like... That clearly wasn't right. Like, my teacher made me, like, put my hand under my chin and, like, count the number of times, like, my hand would go down. And that would be the number of syllables in the word. But it also, like, makes you look like an idiot, talking really slowly and going like this. Yeah, and, like...
I think that was the discussion we had.
Yeah.
Like, I was telling you about a friend of mine who... He, like, went to a school, which he describes as, like, some hick school, an elementary school, and his teacher would be like, it's one syllable, squirrel. Like, squirrel be nuts. Like, that's, like, the explanation. When I was, like, very little, my sister would also tell me, like, she would like, she just had this, like, fantastic imagination. She would always tell me these, like, really long and elaborate stories, and I, like, wouldn't be interested unless all the main characters were animals. and, like, I found out later, like, through a series of, like, I mean, I guess when I got older and, like, started reading more, I realized that she would tell me stories. Like, she would tell me, like, The Wizard of Oz, but, like, change all the characters to animals and tell me it was, like, a story that she had, like, thought of in her dreams. Or, like, I think this happened maybe with, like, The Hobbit also. There were just a ton of stories that I just, like, I just had no clue that I was, like, getting, like, great books through, like...
That's actually really creative
of
your sister.
Did you read them
later?
Some of them I would read later, and some of them someone, I think at some points, like, other people would, like, relate to me in the story, like, plots of books that they'd read, and I'd be like, no, you got that from my sister. It was animals, and she dreamed it, okay? I pretty much thought my sister was entirely infallible for a long time, and she would, like, tell me a lot of things, and I really believe them to be true for, like, many years longer than I should have. And then, like, relate the information to other people and be, like, really insistent about it. And often it was true, but...
I had a sort of opposite experience once where we were having some sort of big family picnic related to an outdoor theater thing in California. And I must have been under 10 years old, and I just watched Clueless, which I thought was the most fantastic thing in the world. All these older people doing wonderful things and so forth. I mean, in retrospect, it is still sort of clever. But at the time, it was really the bee's knees. And there are lots of jokes that don't make sense to children. Right? They're sex jokes and things like this. So there was one of these things that I knew was very funny, but I didn't understand why it was funny. And so we were sitting around the picnic table, and I was sitting with my father's mother, who was very old-fashioned, very, very conservative in her mannerisms, you know, sort of an old dame or something like that, sort of don, quite uptight, would never say anything improper. So I said, "Woo, Grandma Woo, I saw this really funny movie, and there's this girl, and she's on a tennis court, and she says to the tennis coach, I can't play tennis because I can't have balls flying at my face." And the other character says, "Well," and my sister hits me in the arm, "shut up." I'm like, "What? It's funny." "It's not funny. You can shut your mouth."
Wait, what did the other character say?
"There goes your social life." Oh. But I could not say this to my grandmother for obvious reasons.
Were you confused? Were you like...
Yeah, I didn't get it. I'm not sure I learned why it would be part of one's social life. I mean, I guess I assumed she was a dodgeball player or something like that. Until some time later. I don't remember when it was cleared up for me.
When I was younger, I heard the word, like, masturbation in some song. And I, like, would not stop asking my parents and my brother what it meant, because it, like, clearly they were, like, so adamantly against telling me. So I was like, "Why? What does it mean?" Like, they were keeping me out of this, like, big secret. So it was really awkward when I, like, found out.
Yeah, how did you find out?
Well, eventually, I think the way they explained it, they were like, "It's when you touch yourself." And so, like, I thought, you know, like...
You're like, "I'm touching myself."
Yeah, I understood that it was, like, I thought they meant, like, breasts. Not that I, like, had breasts at that point, but I was kind of, like, I just, like, thought for a long time that, like, that was masturbating. Yeah.
The same first grade teacher told us we were going to get summer vacation. She told us a lot of things. But one of the things she told us was it was okay to write one sideways. And, like...
I knew that this wasn't okay. Like, it shook my faith in, like, the uprightness of the numbering system. And, like, I think it was just because, like, she didn't know how to write ones correctly. And, like, so she would, like, write them at, like, a 45-degree angle. And, like, that was pretty traumatic for me. I was like, "No, you're not allowed to do that."
Like, think of the degree of control you have in elementary school. Yeah. I feel like many of them are not equipped to, like, handle that.
And then, oh, the moment, the time, well, actually, there have been several times, several steps along the way where I was losing faith in the educational system to deal with me, but, like, in fourth grade, we were reading Misty Trinketeague, and, like, part of, so, we were near the end of the book, and it was, like, the last, like, 30 pages, and, like, maybe 20 pages, and the teacher was like, "Okay, we're gonna have silent reading time, everybody sit at their desks and finish reading this." So I did, and then, like, I went up to her desk, and I was like, "I'm done." She was like, "No, you're not." Saying them. She's like, "Well, go read it again." I'm like, "What? Why? Like, why?" So, like, I went back to my desk and I read it again. And then she made me start reading it a third time. And I was like, that was the moment at which I realized, like, this teacher is not smarter than I am. Or, like, she knows more, but, like, this teacher cannot, like,
cope with you.
Like, this teacher can't cope with me. And, like, this is, like, a reversal of, like,
just
powers.
Given you another book.
Yeah. She could, like, that would be a logical explanation, you think so, right? And then, like, in first grade, too, like, they would, and I guess, like, probably all the grades, like, they would just make me do work, like, several times, like, the same worksheet. And it was like, this is traumatic for me.
When I was in second grade, I was able to do the math problems effectively enough that the teacher decided to give me something else to work on. So she said, "So you think of two numbers that, or two examples of a number that when you add it to itself, it's the same as multiplying it by itself."
So I, 2.2.
So I said, okay, 2 times 2. And she said, okay, now think of a second one. And I spent days doing this. And I said, what the three? No, 3 doesn't work. Like 1.5? This isn't going to cut it. Now, days and days, and eventually I just kept on asking, please tell me, please tell me. And she said, no, you'll want to think of it. I said, I can't think of it. I can't get it. Two is like this. There are no others. And eventually she said, okay, I'll tell you. Do you really want me to tell you? Yes, there's only the 2. I don't know what to do about this. And she said, 0. 0.
That's cheating. That's not even a number.
I wasn't clever enough to respond. You know, oh, the Arabs thought of that one. That hasn't been a number for as long as the others. I still think this is very clever.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
The Radley Porch on WYBC New Haven, 1340 AM. If you have any comments, suggestions, or submissions, please contact us at theradleyporch@gmail.com.
So, it's been long enough that I no longer remember how old I really was. But I do know that I must have been younger than even middle school. Must have been only 10 or 11. But for some reason, it was the summer, and I'd been left home alone. Entrusted in what I can only imagine to be an illegal amount of self-supervision. I think you have to be 12 in my state to be home alone, legally. And I'm sure I was watching television. I'm sure I was eating my favorite snack of the time, which was cookie dough rolled in sugar. This is the sort of thing I did when I was home alone. And sitting in the main, you know, family room, the den, if you will, I was sitting there, and I heard this rustling, and it was actually pretty loud, I guess, be heard over the TV. And the rustling was pretty significant, and I sort of turned the TV off, sort of looking around, and figured out that it was coming from the fireplace, or really the chimney, to be more accurate. And I opened up the glass doors of the fireplace, and I could really hear that there was something moving around in there. So I called my dad and I said, well, there's something moving around in the fireplace. And he said, well, this has happened before. Animals get into the top of the fireplace, and there's a guard up there that should keep them out, but they've broken the guard before, and it's a really big hassle for me to have to go up there and fix it. So take care of the guard. Get rid of it. I don't want to have to deal with that. So build a fire. He tells me. Build a fire because that will keep the animals from messing with the guard. It'll be too smoky and hot and they won't want to mess with it. It seemed reasonable to me, even though it was the middle of the summer, and coming from a southern state, it was pretty hot already. And I grabbed the Duraflame log because, of course, we didn't have real logs when you're from the south. And put the Duraflame log, fake log, in the fireplace, and, you know, quickly, easily lit it.
With a match, or?
Yeah, just with a match. You know, it was sort of just an easy start, you know, fake log. And close the glass doors in the fireplace, just to protect, you know, from the smoke getting in the house. My mother was allergic. She was always complaining about smoke and fires. And, you know, problem solved. Certainly the rustling ceased. Probably went back to watching television, although I don't remember. The next thing I know for sure happened was pretty memorable, and that was the sound of you know, basically, you know, any type of, mostly like a baseball hitting the ground out in the outfield. I wasn't much of an athlete. This was the sound of the kerplunk right into the damp earth made. And, but it was in the fireplace again. I remember looking there. I couldn't quite make out what was going on, but there was a lot of movement. So I opened the door to the fireplace, the glass doors, and there was definitely something alive, moving, and probably pretty pissed off at that particular juncture. So I did what I always do in these sorts of situations, which was probably to scream, step back, and then collect myself enough, just enough, to close the glass door and put whatever was already on fire further back into the flames. Whereupon I started thinking about what could conceivably really be going on here. Clearly this was more than just a baseball, and it did hit not damp earth, but the fire. And, you know, I made what I can only describe to be my classical decision, which was to bar the door, sealing the fate of whatever it was that I had already set on fire, and proceed immediately to further arm myself against this invader of my home. By obtaining probably our largest and perhaps only real butcher knife from the kitchen, just in case this small thing got out. And, you know, really what I remember more than anything else, I think people usually talk about the smells of fires, but this was not a particularly memorable smell. Not even at the end was it a particularly memorable smell. No, what really I remember most is the sizzling sound. You know, I guess, not necessarily, it's different than you know, any other, there was no snapping or crackling or popping or anything like that. It was just a pretty constant sizzle. I sort of imagined it to be the fur burning off.
Was the animal making noises?
Not this one. Not the first one, no. But pretty soon, the first one was joined by two more. They arrived almost in tandem, and that's when the sizzling got really loud. And now there were three, and now I could tell, too, these weren't burned as quickly, baby raccoons, which I had, let me remind you, used a poker to seal in to the glass doors of the fireplace. And what was I to do, except stand there with a knife in case they perchance broke through the glass? I certainly wasn't going to intervene on their behalf. The image of a flaming baby raccoon setting our carpet on fire
and attacking you,
maybe attacking me, you know, who knows, it was frenzied, but that none of that occurred to me at the time. What I distinctly remember thinking to myself at the time was, if that baby raccoon gets soot on the carpet, my mom is going to be furious. So I knew that this had to be avoided. Whatever the big problem was, it wasn't the biggest. The biggest was keeping soot off the carpet. This whole time I'm being incredibly careful. You know, if I'm going to get the knife, for instance, you know, I wanted to make sure it didn't track any soot. You know, I might have gotten on my hand from the poker or anything, God forbid. So this went on for a while, and the sizzling sound grew louder and softer and louder and softer until finally there was no more movement, and eventually not even any more sizzling. And you know, maybe that was the reason why the mother decided to investigate the situation. And when she hit the flames, she made a lot of noise. This was the sort of pathetic whimpering sound that you might have expected from the baby raccoons, but really it was the mother. And then eventually, you know, I think as she was really burnt or really in pain, it was no longer whimpering, and now it was, you know, real sharp cry. And then she began banging herself into the glass doors, which at that point, you know, okay, baby raccoon's baby raccoon. This is a real, you know, mother raccoon, and I was really afraid for the glass doors at that point. And I was very glad that I had the knife and, you know, worried about it. Now, baby raccoons can only carry so much soot. I mean, this was going to be a real soot ball.
Probably really dirty.
And eventually, you know, she too was lost to the Duraflame log. And I was left with you know, the memory of the sizzling sound and quite a mess for my father to clean up.
So does that give you fear of raccoons or fireplaces?
You know, it certainly made me avoid fireplaces for a while. I would say so, yeah, absolutely. It's no fun watching an animal die.
I can imagine.
Certainly not, perhaps, at my own hand, but, yeah, you know, and certainly not that fireplace ever again.
To this day.
No, we moved, thankfully. You know, it wasn't sort of a memorial, you know, left to be left alone at that point.
So did you feel guilty, even though it wasn't your fault? There was nothing you could have done?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think that when I tell the story, I usually use the word murder to describe it. I always say that, you know, well, did I ever tell you about the time that I murdered the baby raccoons? But the truth is, you know, it wasn't intentional. I was just, you know, and to be honest, I was trying to, in some sense, protect whatever animal it was that was messing with the guard. It really wasn't a good idea for them to be in the chimney in the first place. I mean, it's a chimney. But, you know, best intentions often go awry, I guess. But certainly as a kid, I wasn't able to make that distinction. I just murdered baby raccoons. This wasn't exactly my cup of tea.
You felt pretty bad.
I felt really bad as a kid. I think as I grew older, it was less of an issue.
Porch on Yale Radio 1340.
I think it's sometimes funny how you can, your mind fills in blanks of your memory. And so I have this memory that actually isn't a true memory, but I've heard it many times, so it's almost, and I've told it many times, so now it has become a memory. I was in third grade, and my friends and I had just started a new program, actually, and so a lot of people were new in the program, and so we're all, like, trying to make new friends, and so there were these two girls who were really good friends, because they knew each other before the program, and I became friends with one of them, and I guess I just thought the other one was just not cool enough for us, and I didn't want to be her friend. And I knew that that girl was also afraid of heights. So during recess, we'd go climb up this jungle gym dome. And we'd sit at the top and, like, talk and maybe eat and do other stuff. And we'd just basically leave her out. And this was clearly really upsetting for her. And so she... And our cafeteria also had these really good chocolate chip cookies that were, like, warm and gooey. And people would, like... Like, I remember many times using, like, my lunch money and just buy cookies instead of buying real lunch. And so she actually took her lunch money and bought... You could buy exactly 3 cookies with one equivalent to 1 full lunch. And so she used her lunch money to buy 3 cookies and then came up to us. I guess she must have, like, climbed inside the jungle gym and was, like, below us, and our feet were, like, dangling down, and, like, we would, like, look down at her. And she like, came with these 3 cookies, and she's, like, I'd really like to be your friend, and I brought these 3 cookies, and I wanted to share them with you. And I guess from what other people told me, I looked at her and said, cookies don't buy friendship. and like, climbed down and, like, ran off with her former best friend. And so I don't have a true memory of that, and instead I've just been told, so that happened in 3rd grade, and then I was basically told that story from, like, 7th grade to 12th grade, because I became, like, legitimately good friends with her, like, after, once we reached middle school. And I just remember hearing this story, like, over and over. And I think what mortified me was that I didn't remember the event at all, that it was such a non-event for me, but clearly significant for her, like, her losing her best friend and being left out in such a way. And I feel like in some ways I've been trying to make up for it, like, after that, just sort of being really sensitive of other people, and also being just, like, trying to be a better person. Like, I have to atone for this great horrible thing that I've done, and, like, how can I do that?
I guess I must have been, like, 5 and my sister must have been 7, maybe, but we would, like, go on these family vacations to a beach in Delaware, and, like, we would always be, like, in the back seat together, and it was, like, cramped quarters, and we'd always, like, get into a fight inevitably. And, like, once we were going to the beach, and then, you know, we were both, like, very little, and we, like, got into some kind of a fight about, like, who was crossing the line in the middle of the back seat. and like, we, like, got to the beach, and my sister, like, she told me that it, she, like, told me this, like, whole story about how, like, there were a lot of sharks, like, off the coast of Delaware, and, like, I should be, like, really worried, but it would be okay, like, if there was, like, blood on me, because sharks are afraid of blood. and later, I, like, registered that, like, that's actually not true.
So did she cut you or something?
No, I think it might have been, I don't know if I was, like, bleeding any, like, I, like, had a cut or something, and she told me to go swimming, or it was something, and it was, like, something in fact that she, like, wanted me to swim, like, with blood. And, like, she does not remember this at all.
She does. She has told me this story.
I think I've told it to her enough times that she, like, has recreated it.
Well, I've heard this story from Aisha. And really? She, it's very traumatic for her as well. Really? It's sort of, like, your thing.
Yeah, like, but I think it's funny that, like, I actually don't remember this story, but, like, I now have a mental image, and maybe I even add details that, like, aren't, that weren't told to me, but, like, seem natural. But, yeah, like, I don't actually have a memory of it.
I think I just made it really dramatic. Like, in the intervening years, I think I would tell her about the time she tried to kill me. But it's lately, and the memory has stuck with me.
There was this event. It's funny. We lived in the edge of, in a community that was being developed. And so at the end of the block, more houses were going up, and there was construction crews, and all the... There's a, you know, like a pack of boys. We were ranging from, like, 9 to probably 15. And we get on our bicycles and ride, not 9 to 13. We'd ride all around the neighborhood. There was a caterpillar, what would you call it, a front loader or excavator or something like that at the end of the development. And so one day we were just climbing on it. The construction, we knew other construction workers. In fact, Leonard, I still remember the guy's name, was one of the guys who worked this piece of equipment. And we were climbing on this thing, and there were parents who were cutting the lawn and seeing us do this. And then one of us, I can't remember who, said, oh, let's, you know, sabotage. So they started pouring sand down in the gearbox and doing things in the gas tank and all these, like, really bad things. And I got up to leave thinking, this really isn't right. So I was going to leave, but then one of them, somebody called me a chicken, whatever, so I stayed there, and they were just doing things. And I don't remember how, but the construction crew found out about this. It was on the weekend, and on Monday, and I'm sitting there, you know, with this gnawing feeling in my gut, like this was really bad. So my friends were saying this, the tractor's going to explode, and this would be really, you know, like amazing. And, Leonard came by to my parents' house in the evening. I'm like, oh no, oh this is hard. I was just sick to my stomach. Had a conversation. I never heard anything about it. And then other boys in the neighborhood, they were grounded, or they had to pay like a huge amount of money. And for years, I didn't quite understood why I wasn't grounded. Clearly, my parents weren't happy, but I, you know, and they had to write a check. But then over time, I kind of forgot about it. But it would come up, you know, once in a while, it would pop in my head. And I'd feel really bad about this thing. But the story was never complete in my mind. It wasn't until I was in my mid-20s when I found out that, because I knew that if I told my parents I didn't do anything, they wouldn't believe me, because there were witnesses all over the place. It turns out that one of the parents who saw us climbing all over the tractor told my parents I wanted to leave and tried it, didn't want to be there anymore. But I was talking, and I really hadn't done anything. But they felt, just for neighborhood unity, that, you know, all the parents were paying like $1,000 or whatever it was to fix this tractor. Okay. So they knew this whole time I hadn't done anything, but I had just felt this lingering back in my head kind of guilt that I'd done something bad. Now, is that fear? I don't know if it was fear.
I have a story too that I actually remember this one, but that I feel really bad about in retrospect, and even like I still think about it, it makes me question like my morality as a person. It was in sixth grade, and we were taking Latin, and our Latin teacher was kind of, he was very young, like very, like, he looked kind of like a Greek god. I think he was just, like, bored teaching us. I don't know. So one day, he always was trying to teach us SAT words, so one day he was going to teach us about the concept of ostracizing people, which I guess came from Athens, and every year, I think it comes from, like, pottery shards, like, so every year the Athenians would vote on a pottery shard for someone they wanted to kick out. I don't remember if it was every year, but periodically they would vote. And so he taught us about this, and then he was like, okay, to like really bring home the concept, everyone in the class is going to vote for the person they would like to kick out of the class. So we were all kind of horrified, like, you want us to write down the name of a person we want to kick out of the class? It was like, we were kind of horrified, but at the same time, you know, we were 11 or 12, and our teacher was telling us, write down the name of the person you want to kick out of the class. So, like, you don't really know what to do. So, you know, I sat there, and I was like, okay, like, who's the most annoying kid in the class? And I don't actually remember who I voted for. But I think also some of it, too, was, like, I didn't really, like, examine deeply my own personal feelings, but it was just, like, who is perceived as, like, the loser of the class. I'll just vote for that person. I don't remember who I ended up voting for, but I think it wasn't, like, deeply personal. Like, who do I hate most in the class? It was, like, who is perceived as the loser of the class, and I think that's how I kind of made my decision. So then he had us tally up the votes on the board. It was, like, you know, so-and-so, one vote for this person, one vote for this person, you know, so we're all, like, watching it. It's totally horrifying, and mostly it is the kids who are unpopular, don't have a lot of friends. There was one vote for, like, a popular girl in the class, you know, and so at the end, it's this boy, Cannell, and our Latin teacher says, okay, Cannell, you need to leave the room, and, you know, this poor boy bursts into tears, and is just a wreck for the rest of the day, so, you know, what was my Latin teacher thinking? but then it also makes, you know, it makes us think about all of us, like, you know, you think you wouldn't go along with something so horrible, but someone in authority tells you to do it, and you're like, okay, I mean, and I mean, you know, even as an 11-year-old, like, you knew this wasn't going to end well, but, like, I didn't have the courage to stand up and be like, no, this is mean, you know, so that's definitely a story that I still look back on and think, what was going on there?
I have a story that was very dramatic at the time.
seems very strange and weird now. My family was really close with this family that lived down the street, the Ewings, and I was really close with their daughter, Allison. And our two families went to this little country inn together one weekend, and there was horses, stables, and fields, and whatever, and we played around, and Allison loved horses, so we went to the horses stable, and there's two horses in the stable, just kind of prancing around. And so our moms gave us apples to give to the horses, because that's what you do with horses, you feed them stuff. And so I'm like, you know, 6 or 7, and I think this is so cool, but I also think Allison is so cool, because she's a year older than me, and she's a lot taller than me, and she knows everything about horses, and she can draw horses.
Well,
so she clearly knows more than I do. And she says to me, okay, you have to throw the apple to the horse, and then the horse will eat it, and that'll be great. And she threw her apple to the horse, and it fell on the ground, and the horse ate it, and he was happy. So I took my apple, and I heaved it at the horse, and it hit the horse right in the middle of the forehead. And she turns to me, and just looks at me, and says, well, that's the softest place on the horse's head, so you probably killed it. And then she flounced away, and I was petrified, because I was like the little goody-goody kid who never did anything wrong and worried about everything and wanted to never disappoint anyone and never do anything wrong, and I thought I just killed a horse. And so I like ran away and didn't say anything, but then for like literally the next 9 months, I was so scared that somebody was going to call my mom and be like, the horse at the inn died, and your daughter threw an apple at its face, and that's why it died. And it was so dramatic, and last year I ended up telling my friend this story, and she thought it was so funny, and she had no idea that she'd ever done anything like this, but she thought it was very typical of herself at 7, because she knew so much about horses, and she just kind of was out there, and I was just so traumatized.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to 3. Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation. What we'll see will defy explanation.
This discussion of the transformative power of imagination reminds us of a passage from Wordsworth's Prelude, in which as a young boy he steals a boat and paddles out onto a lake towards a mountain. When from behind that craggy steep, till then the bound of the horizon, a huge cliff, as if with voluntary power instinct, upreared its head. I struck and struck again, and growing still in stature, the huge cliff rose up between me and the stars, and still, with measured motion, like a living thing strode after me. With trembling hands I turned and through the silent water stole my way back to the cavern of the willow tree. There, in her mooring place, I left my bark, and through the meadows homeward went with grave and serious thoughts. And after I had seen that spectacle, for many days my brain worked with a dim and undetermined sense of unknown modes of being. In my thoughts, there was a darkness, call it solitude or blank desertion, no familiar shapes of hourly objects, images of trees, of sea, or sky, no colors of green fields, but huge and mighty forms that do not live like living men move slowly through my mind by day, and were the trouble of my dreams.
That's all of my poem, and I want to listen to my poem now. I want to listen to it.
Okay. Thanks for joining us on the Radley Porch on WYBC New Haven. Tune in for our next show about eavesdropping and spying.